Let me start with a number, because the number is almost impossible to believe until you stand next to it. 385 feet. That's the wingspan of the airplane we're talking about today. Longer than a football field with both end zones thrown in, wider than the Wright brothers' entire first flight at Kitty Hawk twice over with room to spare. I'm Vector, and this is Clear Direct on Radio Hangar, where we take the machines that sound like science fiction and break them down until they make sense. Today, we're standing in the strange and wonderful place where airplanes stop being airplanes and start becoming launch pads. This is the story of the biggest wing that has ever flown, and the little hypersonic airplane it was built to drop. Let's break this down. The airplane is called Rock. One word, like the giant bird out of the old sailor's legends, the one big enough to carry an elephant in its talons. The company that built it is called Stratolaunch, out of the Mojave Air and Spaceport in California. And Rock is, right now, the largest aircraft by wingspan ever to leave the ground. Not the largest by weight. The Antonov An-225, before it was destroyed, was heavier, but by sheer span, wingtip to wingtip, nothing humans have ever built has reached this far. Before we go further, this segment is supported by AviationSoul.com. They make Aviation Challenge coins that mark the real milestones. First solo private pilot instrument-rated CFI the whole journey. Beautifully made and built to last. If you've got a milestone worth remembering, or somebody in your life who just earned one, that's AviationSoul.com. Now, let me paint the airplane for you, because the shape is the whole engineering story. Picture two airplane fuselages, side by side, joined together by one enormous continuous wing across the top two bodies, one wing. It looks like somebody took two airliners and welded them together at the shoulder. Between those two fuselages, slung underneath that center wing, is empty space. And that empty space is the entire point of the machine. The pilots fly Rock from the right-hand fuselage. The left one has no crew at all. Six engines hang under the wing, three on each side, and here's a detail I love. Those engines, the landing gear, the flight deck instruments, huge amounts of this airplane were not designed from scratch. They came off of Boeing 747 airliners, two of them retired and stripped for parts. The engines are the same Pratt and Whitney turbofans that pushed jumbo jets across oceans for decades. 28 wheels on the landing gear. Maximum takeoff weight around 1.3 million pounds. Here's what most people miss. Building an airplane this size from a blank sheet would have cost a fortune and taken forever. So the engineers did what good engineers do. They begged, borrowed, and adapted. Rock is, in a very real sense, two 747s that grew a shared wing and forgot how to be airliners. That's not a criticism, that's smart. When your airplane exists to do one weird job, you don't reinvent the turbofan. So, what is the weird job air launch? And to understand why anybody would build a 385-foot airplane to do it, you have to understand the tyranny of getting off the ground. When you launch anything toward space or toward the edge of it, the hardest, most expensive, most fuel-hungry part happens in the first few miles. Down low, the air is thick. Your rocket or your vehicle is fighting drag, fighting gravity, burning enormous energy just to claw up through the soup near the surface. The lower 40,000 feet of the atmosphere is where dreams go to die and fuel budgets go to burn. So here's the idea, and it is an old idea. What if you didn't start on the ground? What if a big, patient subsonic airplane carried your vehicle up high, first up above most of the weather, up above most of the thick air, then let go? Now your vehicle starts its real work at 40,000 feet, already moving forward at hundreds of miles an hour, with a huge chunk of the atmosphere already beneath it. That's air launch! And pilots already know a version of this in their bones. It's the same reason a glider gets towed up before it flies. It's the same reason we talk about density altitude on a hot day at a high field. Thick air low down is expensive. Thin air up high is cheap. Rock's whole reason to exist is to move the starting line from the ramp to the flight levels. The data tells an interesting story here, and it's worth being honest about. Air launch is not a free lunch, you pay for it. You pay by building and maintaining a gigantic airplane. You pay in complexity, in a carrier aircraft that has to be inspected and crewed and hangared and flown safely with something heavy and expensive bolted underneath it. The question that has haunted this entire idea for 20 years is simple. Does the money you save by starting high outweigh the money you spend owning the world's largest airplane? For a while, the answer looked like no. And that brings us to the sad middle of this story. Stratolaunch was founded by Paul Allen. If that name rings a bell, yes, the same Paul Allen who co-founded Microsoft. He was a genuine aviation and space enthusiast, and he'd already helped bankroll Spaceship One, the little rocket plane that won the Ansari X Prize back in 2004 by reaching the edge of space twice in 2 weeks. Allen loved air launch. He believed in it. And in 2011, he set out to build the mothership to end all motherships. The original plan was enormous in ambition. ROC was going to carry big orbital rockets up to altitude and drop them, turning any long runway into a spaceport. No fixed launch pad, no waiting on a narrow window at a coastal range. Just take off, fly to the drop point, and release. Then two things happened. Paul Allen died in 2018 before he ever saw ROC fly, and the rocket world changed underneath the whole concept. SpaceX started landing boosters and bringing the cost of ordinary ground launch down so fast that the economic case for dropping big rockets off an airplane started to wobble. The very problem ROC was built to solve was getting solved a different way. ROC flew for the first time in April of 2019, a few months after Allen's death. It got off the ground beautifully. And then, for a while, it looked like a magnificent airplane in search of a mission, the largest wingspan in history, and nowhere obvious to point it. Here's where the story gets interesting again, and here's the part I think is genuinely smart. The company got bought by a new owner, and instead of chasing the shrinking market for launching rockets to orbit, they looked at what ROC was actually good at, and found a completely different customer who was desperate for exactly that. Not space, quite. The edge of it, hypersonics. Let me explain what hypersonic means and why every defense department on Earth is suddenly throwing money at it. Hypersonic, in the technical sense, means faster than about Mach 5, five times the speed of sound, roughly 3,800 miles an hour and up. At those speeds, the air stops behaving like the friendly stuff we fly through. It heats up violently against the skin of the vehicle. The physics of the shockwaves change. Materials that are perfectly happy at airliner speeds start to glow and soften. Flying hypersonic is one of the hardest problems in all of aerospace, and the United States, for a variety of reasons, spent a couple of decades not doing very much of it while other nations pushed ahead to catch up. You have to test, a lot. You need to fly real hardware at real hypersonic speeds over and over, and measure what actually happens, because the wind tunnels and the computer models only get you so far. And testing hypersonic vehicles has historically been rare, slow, and eye-wateringly expensive. Every test was a national event. You might get a handful a year. And that is the gap ROC walked right into. Stratolaunch built a second vehicle to go with the mothership, a small, sleek, rocket-powered airplane called Talon A. Think of it as a reusable hypersonic testbed. It's autonomous, no pilot on board. It's about the size of a small business aircraft's fuselage, packed with a rocket motor and a bay full of test instruments and customer experiments. Here's how the whole system works together, and it's beautiful in its logic. ROC. The giant takes off from a normal runway with Talon A cradled between its two fuselages. It climbs patiently up toward the mid-30s or 40s in altitude, out over a range where it's safe to make some noise. At the drop point, it releases Talon A, the little vehicle falls clear, lights its rocket motor, and accelerates into the hypersonic regime, screaming past Mach 5 while its sensors record everything. It carries payloads for the customer, experiments that need real hypersonic conditions, real heat, real shock. Then, and this is the part that changes the economics, Talon A doesn't get thrown away. It's designed to come back and land on a runway like an airplane. Reusable. Refly it. Do it again next week. That's the whole pitch. Turn hypersonic testing from a rare, throw-it-away national event into something closer to an airline schedule. Fly often, recover the hardware, bring the cost per test down by an order of magnitude, and they've started actually doing it. In late 2024 and into 2025, Stratolaunch flu-powered Talon A vehicles reached hypersonic speeds and recovered the vehicle. That's the milestone that matters. Not a paper airplane, not a rendering on a website. Actual reusable hypersonic flights dropped from the actual airplane under contracts with the United States military's testing programs. The Missile Defense Agency and a Pentagon test initiative are among the customers. This is real work being flown, being paid for. Now let me be the honest broker here, because I promised you balanced and I meant it. The pros are genuine. Air launch really does let you start high, which for a hypersonic testbed means you can reach test conditions with a smaller, cheaper vehicle than if you launched from the deck. The mothership is reusable, and the test vehicle is reusable, which is the holy grail for anybody who needs to test constantly. And frankly, there is enormous strategic demand right now for exactly this capability, which means the customer base is real and funded, not speculative. This is a case study in a company finding its true mission by paying attention to what its hardware was actually good at instead of what it was originally sold as. But the cons are real too, and I won't wave them away. You still own the world's largest airplane, one of a kind. When something is one of a kind, every spare part is a custom part. Every mechanic is learning as they go, and there is no second airframe if the first one has a bad day. Single vehicle programs are fragile by nature. Rock has to be maintained, crewed, and flown with enormous care, and the cost of keeping a machine like this healthy is not small. There's also the question of whether hypersonic testing demand stays hot. Right now, it's a national priority, and the checks are being written. Defense priorities shift. A program built around one customer sector is only as stable as that sector's budget. And the biggest, most honest caveat of all, this is early. A handful of successful powered flights is a real achievement, and I don't want to diminish it. But it is not yet a routine, high-cadence operation. The promise is fly often, recover, refly, do it weekly. The reality today is a young program that has proven the concept works and now has to prove it can do it again and again and again reliably on schedule, without breaking the one airplane it can't replace. The gap between it worked and it works routinely is where a lot of aerospace dreams have quietly died. Ask anybody who followed reusable rockets through the 2000s. The concept was proven decades before it became ordinary. So here's where I land. Rock is not vaporware. That's the important thing. I've spent enough time on this show warning you about beautiful renderings that never leave the hangar. And this is not that. This is a real flying 385-foot airplane that has already dropped real hypersonic vehicles and gotten them back. The engineering is sound. The mission is honest. The customers are paying. What it hasn't done yet is become routine. And that's the whole game now. Not can it work, but can it work over and over cheaply, on a schedule the way its whole promise depends on. Here's what I find most satisfying about this story as an engineer. Rock was built for one dream, launching rockets to orbit, and that dream faded out from under it. A lesser outcome would have been a museum piece, the biggest airplane nobody needed. Instead, somebody looked hard at a machine that was superb at carrying heavy things high and letting go. And they found the one customer on Earth who needed exactly that, and needed it badly. The airplane didn't change. The mission found it. There's a lesson in that about building things. Sometimes the tool comes first, and the right job shows up late. My thanks to Stratolaunch for the flight details and the program milestones, to Aviation Week for the reporting, and to the Department of Defense's hypersonic testing programs for the context on why any of this matters. If you want to see photos of Rock, and you really should, because no description does that wing justice, come find us at RadioHangar.com. The biggest wing ever flown, built to drop a little airplane at the edge of the sky. I'll take that over science fiction any day. This is Vector. Keep looking up, and keep asking how it works.